Thanks for checking out the Improv Comedy Connection podcast. And this, our very first episode, I'm Whit Schiller and I'll be your host. I'm not going to go into a long monologue on the why for this new podcast because I want to jump right into the main content. But in short, the things we'll talk about will in one way or the other involve connecting better with others when comedy and humor are involved. I'm an improviser, so you'll certainly get to hear from some amazing improvisers. But I also plan to interview stand-up and sketch comedians, humorists, communicators, and others who have something to say about being funny in front of other people on a deeper, more satisfying level. That's what the Improv Comedy Connection podcast is all about, and I hope it helps you be a better improviser, comedian, writer, or communicator. So let me set up episode one for you. Andiel Sudik is our guest. She's an improviser and actor out of LA and Chicago, but she also does sketch comedy, and she teaches improv all over the world. She got her start at I.O., formerly Improv Olympic, before getting cast with Second City's touring company and then for one of their stages. But she also spent time in Amsterdam with Boom Chicago. She's had an interesting journey along the way, more than can fit into a single episode, but I know you'll appreciate hearing from Andiel. So let's get right into this episode with Andiel Sudik on the Improv Comedy Connection.
So,
all right, so today we get to talk to Andiel Sudik. I am really looking forward to spending some time with you, Andiel, and you kind of preceded our conversation today with a couple things that you've got on your mind today that I think will be a lot of fun to talk about. It's, I think, always helpful to have a little sense of how you got into improv and sketch comedy. Those are the two major things that you are doing in terms of the kind of topics that we talk about here on the podcast, right?
Yeah. So I grew up in California. My dad was an actor. And before I was born, my mom was also an actress and a seamstress. And then she was a teacher when I was a little kid. She decided to become an elementary school teacher. And so I've always been kind of in the theater. And then in high school, I found out about this thing that happened on the Santa Monica Pier called the Second City Jam, the Second City Alumni Jam. And so members who had been a part of different Second Cities just got together every Wednesday and did three pieces of long form improv. And it was the first time I had ever seen that. And it blew my mind. And it also became this like really exciting thing for me as a 15-year-old and my friend Amanda to do every week. Like it was so special. We paid, it was like $5. And it was in this like old maybe restaurant or bar that wasn't really open. Because
you're just a teenager then.
Yeah. So it wasn't like I didn't get carded at the door, which I feel like most places in LA do. So it was also like just kind of perfect that it happened to be this kind of underground thing. It was before Second City had a space here or anything at all. And so we started doing that every Wednesday. And when I was little, we had gone to visit my dad in Chicago when he was doing Singing in the Rain. And then again, when he was doing Waiting for Godot. And we got to stay with him in artist quarters, and I fell in love with the city of Chicago, so I always knew that I wanted to live there. I thought the city was magic. And so after high school, I did, and I went with the intention of getting a theater degree, and I did not do that, and I just started improvising. Yeah. And that kind of took over.
So I want to follow up on that, but so when you were... When you were watching, because that's interesting in and of itself, but just before I lose the thought, when you were watching these alumni jams, were these big crowds, small crowds? I mean, it was not in a theater type setting, right? You said it was in kind of a bar setting.
Yeah, it was like, so it was, but I don't know if it was a bar because it wasn't open. Like, I don't know if they served anything. My memory sucks, but it was kind of like cabaret style. And it got, people came to see it, but not as many people as should have based on what it was, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. And it was good. And I know that's like, you know, shiny, like my shiny, innocent eyes remembering it, but it was. And we found out later, like, they were our heroes. And I think we, like, got up the courage to talk to one of them once. but I found out later, like, when I found out who they were, like they were all, you know, writing for television at that point and had obviously been in the Second City. So they were all like actually doing real things. And this was just a kind of mess around thing.
Yeah. Just doing it for fun.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I got to meet a couple of them, one of whom I'm going to be who's teaching at the Oslo Festival, which I'm really geeked out about because I'm also teaching there. But I got to meet and thank him years later and kind of like ask about it. And he was like, oh, yeah, we would just meet up before the show. We would all throw our names in a hat and then we would get split into three groups and then we'd just do the shows. And I was like, what? Oh.
So cool. So the draw to Chicago, though, was not so much that it was a Second City, folks. It was that you had gotten to know Chicago a little bit and were looking at it, pursuing more on a theater side.
Yeah, well, it was, yeah. I don't know why I was going to go on this like big, long answer. Like, yep, that's the answer.
Okay. Very well, you know, efficiency is appreciated by everybody.
Of course.
But okay, so then you are pursuing a theater degree and then you bag it pretty quick.
Well, I quit it a week before classes started. So I went through, like, I enrolled, I signed up for my perfect schedule, and a week before classes started, I quit.
That's a big shift for someone to make at that point in life.
Yeah, honestly, I think I was afraid of being in debt, and I didn't, like, understand the financial, like, I didn't understand anything financial enough to feel like I was making a smart decision getting loans for that. And so it was like that. And then also my, like, little, you know, 18-year-old brain was like, when you know what you want to go to college for, you'll go to college. And I think at that point I was like, yeah, I just kind of, like, I'd started improvising maybe a month before and I was really, really getting into that. And I kind of always thought that I would go back to get my teaching degree when I went back to college.
And then where are you taking classes at that point? Because you were already taking improv classes before the college was supposed to start for you?
Yeah. So me and my friend Amanda drove out and then we stayed with her dad in Wisconsin and we would drive in every week to go to classes at IO, which was then known as Improv Olympic, because I'm pretty sure the reason that we started taking classes there was because we had unintentionally moved in like two blocks away from that theater. And so we're like, oh, that's the one.
It was convenient.
Like I look back on just all of the choices I made so confidently and in like the weirdest ways.
What was that experience like with IO? Because you also end up trying some other things as opposed to kind of sticking with one school and running the table on that.
Oh, yeah. So it was amazing. So we started taking classes there. And I started doing as many shows as I could. I started interning there so I could pay for classes and see as many shows as I could and just got super, super into that world. And then 2 years after I moved there, like the big thing in that community, at least at the time, was like, then you auditioned at Second City because that's the theater that you got paid to do this at. So like that was kind of like the next shiny goal for a lot of us, especially at that time. And so I auditioned the first time and I was like, well, okay. And then the second time I auditioned, I got hired as an understudying to the touring company. And so then I kind of shifted, kept doing as much as I could at IO, but shifted to touring sketch and improvisation.
And had you been taking classes at Second City or did you just go right to audition and then getting cast?
Well, so technically the first improv class I ever took was the high school Second City class in Los Angeles, which was a very weird before I moved to Chicago. But then once I was in Chicago, IO was the only program I went through. I just auditioned at Second City.
And then how old are you when you're getting cast on a touring company?
So I believe I was 19 when I got hired as an understudy. And then I think I was 20 by the time I started, like, but by the time I was put in a company and was touring. And then I turned 21 on the road. I do remember that.
So when you're an understudy, are you filling in then when there's someone who's not able to make it? Or is that more just kind of studying?
No, it is like you're filling in when they need you, or if they have like extra shows that they don't have a company for, they'll put you into that. But the best part about being an understudy was getting to like go to Second City, and they had what they call the war room, which is where you just like hang out. And at the time, because this was 1,000 years ago, there was a big cupboard, and they had all of the reviews, all the scripts, and then also I think VHSs still, maybe DVDs, but I think VHSs. Okay. So you could sit in the war room and watch all of the old reviews and read along, because some of them, like from the 80s, some of them you could hardly like see what was going on, but you could read the scripts along with it. So I kind of got comfortable with the archives that way, because when you tour, a lot of what you do is you perform archival material.
Yeah, that sounds like a ton of fun. Because there's been so many great sketches over the years.
Yeah.
And so many of them, unless you were at the show, you just, you don't have any access to it. So you ultimately end up moving to Boom Chicago after touring for, a couple years or so?
So I toured for a couple years, and then I got hired to Boom Chicago. I think it ended up being like a year after I quit touring. And so I moved to Amsterdam to work at Boom Chicago.
That's a very interesting place. I'm not having been, but just being in a different cultural environment. I mean, it's Boom Chicago. So the expectation is that this is going to be an American or Chicago style entertainment experience, right? For your audiences?
I think the name, I can't remember how they named it. It's because the guys are from Chicago. And so we tried to do like more either Universal material or stuff that specifically works in the Netherlands. So it was less, I would say it's less Chicago style, but definitely English speaking was like a main thing, which is how they can like work it so we can work out there.
Right. And those audiences are very different than American audiences.
Yeah. So they're either heavily Dutch or more like when I worked there, because it was right on the Leidseplein, which is a very touristy area. It was a lot of like international tourists. So a lot of audiences where English is not necessarily the first language, but they absolutely speak it better than you speak any of their languages. And the shows there, like what I loved about it and definitely what I learned from it was they're like bigger, the tech there, like all of the technicians were absolutely amazing. So they were more tech heavy, and you couldn't rely on some things that some improvisers rely on in the States, like pop culture references do not work there,
right.
Which is good because I have no pop culture reference level. So that was like great for me. But yeah, it was definitely an adjustment. And then just living there was a huge culture shock for me, because I had never until that point, I'd maybe been to Mexico once, but I'd never been outside the country. So that was a huge, huge deal. And I was very, I think very young. So it's a huge culture shock.
It's Dutch culture, which is very open. And I mean, you can go into it, and it's something that can certainly suck you in a way that's a lot different. Yeah. With regard to the improv part of it, though, do you feel like the type of work that you had to do because the audience was different impacts what you or how you approach improv or comedy today?
Oh, for sure. I think so. I think stylistically, it already meshed with what I enjoy and what I'm good at, which is kind of like bigger, broader, more emotional improvisation. Because I very much like the idea of comedy or improvisation that can reach anyone. You know, like I have different philosophies depending on, where I'm at in my life on that. But I do like the idea that some things are universal. And so I think that was really cool to get to explore and to get to feel really good at and figure out how to communicate when words are maybe not the first thing. So philosophically, I think it's inspired a lot of my teaching, which is definitely, it's rarely like words are the most important thing.
I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm doing the podcast, is to look for some of those things that are kind of universal, or how do you mm-hmm. have an art form where you can be more connected? And I think you mm-hmm. probably see that more clearly when you don't have some of those tools, or those crutches, maybe too strong of a mm-hmm. word, but some of those things that you go to where you don't have to lead out as much with who you are individually or as a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So then you come back to the States after that. And what do you do after Boom Chicago?
Oh, a thousand things. I worked a lot on Second City for a while, was on cruise ships. So like throughout about a 10-year period, whenever I didn't know what I was doing, I would get to do a cruise ship contract, which I am so thankful and grateful, because I have so many wonderful and amazing memories, and also terrible ones, because, you know, life is nuanced. But I got to work on cruise ships a bunch. So I did that when I very first got back. And then I really started teaching more in Chicago. And then I got hired to do a resident show at Second City and did that. And then kept like teaching as much as I could along the way. So that's kind of like when I got back from Boom, I would say that's when teaching started taking a bigger role in my life.
And for Second City or other theaters or independently?
For Second City, for sure. A little bit independently. I'm trying to think of when that really started. That started a little bit later. Independently and along the way. And then also later for the Revival Theater, which is on the south side of Chicago in Hyde Park. And then I occasionally teach workshops at Annoyance. And I got to coach at IO a little bit.
When we started talking about some things, like I said, leading up to the podcast, one of the things that came up was a post that someone you know put together regarding the maybe cavalier use of the phrase yes and certainly this podcast is going to be heavy on improv, because that's what I do, and there's certainly a core interest there, but for those who don't know, that's sort of a foundational principle of improv, and it gets bandied about. So what was it that you kind of took from that, I guess, voice about the use of the term yes and?
Well, I think it was a post by a woman named Trish, and I think she put into words put more eloquently some of the thoughts that I have and the frustration that I find with that phrase being the leader of people's understanding of improvisation, which I think it's like the yes and in the way that it's used in improv, which is especially like when you're first starting out, the idea of saying yes and then adding to it while you're already in a scene is great. And it's an amazing training wheel. But I feel that we overuse it, and occasionally to the detriment of like a group and people in the group being heard outside of that like scenic improvisation. That was a little rambly.
That's okay. So yeah. I'll cut it way down. It is a phrase that I think some people will take and say that this is their entire life philosophy. And you can hang a lot on that term, or you could also use it as a shorthand for something that speaks to something deeper than just take what someone said and have a no criticism of it, just add something to it, and you just keep kind of ping-ponging back and forth. That ends up being kind of shallow after a while. No improv scene can just be about adding information back and forth.
Well, yeah, and I think it can, but that's one type of scene. And, you know, in improv or in comedy, you're looking for a variety. So, like, you don't even if you're taking that idea scenically, there's still more nuance to it. So,
Well, so what then would you say is the, this is kind of a big question. What is the way that you would summarize what good improv is? What are the core things that make for good art in improv?
Presence and connection and agreement. And I feel like that's as much of a general, I mean, I'll have to think about it more, see if I can come up with something prettier. But I feel like those are the things where when I see good improv, those are the ingredients.
I was thinking too, like how to capture the entirety of it is, like I said, that's an awful big question. I think we like as people to have those shorthands, those quick hitter things to say, well, this is what it is, but it's obviously more, like you said, nuanced. Do you think of certain moments or scenes that you say that's where it really clicked, you know, where you saw it or where when you were in it, like this was like as good as it gets? What was it about those moments that, if you can think of some examples?
I feel like the agreement to play, and then it's the same thing of like good writing to me, where it's like I want the ending to feel inevitable and also surprising. And I think you have to be on the ride. So I like shows where the players are on the ride together and we don't know where we're going. But if we happen to get there, it's a celebration. And if we don't, we really enjoyed the ride. And I think the more that the audience is included in that, that's why improv, you know, is because it's the people on stage and it's the connection to the audience. And that's the part that's magic, because that's the part that will never happen again. So it's this like beautiful magic of like this, we created this thing and it's gone now. And that's okay. I think that also like philosophically sounds nice to me, because I, you know, in life, hold on so tight to wanting things to last or wanting things to be meaningful. Mm-hmm. And so like having something that truly is like, no, it's exciting that it'll never happen again is a nice reminder to me.
So you mentioned the audience being a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
What pulls an audience in to those kind of moments? What do you have to do?
Whew, that's such a, who knows, right? I think I honestly.
All right, well, let's move on then.
That's going to be all my answers. You're like, okay. I think like a level of, I do think it's presence, because I think that's the same. I'm trying to think if I think that's true. It's the same in theater. It's like you can tell when someone's in the room.
Yeah.
And so I think that's definitely part of it. And then I know for me, when people are genuinely playing, or when you see an actual discovery or someone surprise themselves, I know that draws me in. So I don't know if that's like true about, I don't know that that would be true about audiences, but I know that's true about me. Like those are the moments that I'm like, oh, here we go.
Yeah, because I don't know. I feel like this isn't something that we talk about a lot, at least in improv. Maybe and I'm going to see what others might say in other disciplines in comedy or communication. But, you know, there are times where you go into a room and the audience has a certain feel to it. And sometimes it's electric and you know you're going to have a tremendous show. It's almost like it doesn't matter what you do. It's just going to be a good night. And there are other times where it's like you've got to, you know, you've got to ramp it up to get the audience to come along. There's something going on there that I think if you put yourself out there, you said presence was a factor. I tend to think that means that you've put yourself out there and it's okay to be together in that moment where a lot of times we don't have that experience with other people. Don't you think?
Yeah, I like that.
Do you find that it is an easy thing for you to be comfortable on stage, or is it a difficult thing?
Generally, very easy. Like, generally, it is not the only time, because that's very dramatic, but it is the time where I feel most myself and most present, generally. Not always, but usually that's what it is. And I think that's why when I found improv and started doing it, I think that's why I clicked with it so much, because I am someone who lives in my head very much so. And to have this thing that feeds me while I'm there, that I don't have to be in my head for, that I'm not in my head for, was kind of magical for me. Every once in a while, it is not true. And that depends on, you know, like my, where I'm at in my mental state. And also occasionally, like if I feel like there's certain expectations or like there's a certain chemistry, like you said, you walk into a space or into a group. And if I can't settle, then occasionally it feels very hard. So that's definitely still true, which is good, because I think that I still have those feelings and have to navigate those situations make me better at teaching. Because if I was always comfortable and always good, that'd be amazing. But I don't think I'd be as good at teaching, because I think the most I have to offer is the mistakes that I've made and the ways that I've learned to navigate things that are difficult for me.
But why do you think it is easier for you to not be on your head on stage than in real life?
I don't think the
minute I asked the question, I'm like, am I being intrusive here?
It's no. Like,
what's wrong with you, Auntie Ella? I don't mean it that way. Because no, you're not the only person that I've heard say that. And being in your head on stage is a huge issue for tons of improvisers, right?
Yeah.
So what is it that allows somebody to be more comfortable on stage than off it? I don't know. That's interesting to me.
Yeah, honestly, I don't. That's something I'll say that I didn't have to learn, because that was organically true. Like I walked on stage and I was like, I feel good. And this is where I want to be. So that was like an organic thing. But I wonder if part of it is the breaking down, you know, like the first things that you learn in improv is like, if you're in the, like, you've got to, like meditation, you've got to try to stay in the moment. Because if you're in the moment, you can build this together. If you're in your head or you're getting ahead of yourself, it's going to be more difficult. Which is not to say that's not going to happen, like meditation. You're just going to try to lightly pull yourself back to the moment if it starts happening.
You also mentioned that where it isn't as comfortable is where maybe you have some expectations. And maybe you're more aware of expectations in real life than you are on stage, or the stakes feel different to you.
Yeah, or you have, the stakes for sure. Or you have, or you just like allow yourself to have time to feel and think and overthink, where like on stage, it's like, nope, I got to make this choice now. I'm either going to make it or I'm not. And so like for me, from like years of practice and also like the fun of it, it feels like there's less to lose maybe in that moment. Whereas in life, coming from like a particularly pessimistic point of view, I have everything to lose all the time.
In those moments, do you think when you aren't as comfortable that it's just the show isn't as good, or you don't have the moments, and so you kind of are almost like on a death march to the end of the show? Or are you able to rally yourself pretty well?
It depends. Sometimes I am, and sometimes I'm not. And then I let myself, you know, do my little spiral after the show. And then think through the things that I would change, either about like if I did any prep for the show, what I would change, or if there's like certain moments or certain moves that I made, I'll let myself like problem solve those so that I can then like close that off and be like, great, here are the things that I could have done. I didn't do any of those. That show is gone. And I'm getting like, the more shows you do, the easier it is to let those moments go.
So getting back to that yes and article, there is probably a good chunk of improvisers who might say that you've always got to be in that sort of accepting, and there's no, almost like no bad improv. Do you feel that there is bad improv? maybe not terrible choices, but better or more productive choices than just whatever gets thrown out there.
Of course there's bad improv. Anyone who's seen a bad improv show knows that that's true. I think like context is a big key into like stuff like that. So in a classroom setting, I feel like if you're trying to like help people learn, you're trying to like push them and move them to find new things. I think that idea of like, there's no bad ideas is an awesome training wheel, to get through mm-hmm. what we are socialized to do, which is need to be right or have to know what's going on. And so, like, for the first while, I think that idea is so useful. I think the part that I'm most wary of, or the part mm-hmm. that I think it's really important for me as a teacher, for me as an artist, to have my awareness on, is like choice. Not everything is an acceptable choice, especially in the world we live in, especially when we're saying like we want to have a lot of different perspectives in this room. I think mm-hmm. then you have to be more willing to look at like at everything, like a diversity of perspective. If someone says something that is hurtful or offensive or tears someone else in the room down, like that is not an okay, I don't think that's an okay choice in improvisation. Yeah. Where we're saying like we need to work collaboratively, it's like, yeah, in an art form that was primarily white and male, some of the standards were maybe not set in the right place. And so like, in order to allow more voices into the discussion, I do think you need to think of yes and in a different way. Did that make sense?
I think it does. Cause you know, when I look at, I don't know, a few years ago, and I think there's still kind of percolating out there, you know, that some theaters have had to hire like HR consultants to deal with yeah. harassment issues.
Yeah.
Or there are situations where people take advantage of you have to accept whatever mm-hmm. I put out there. And it can be a bullying kind of thing
yeah.
where you're not considerate of the other person's mm-hmm. temperament or personal view or just even kind of personal integrity and value, mm-hmm. I think sometimes. And to me, it seems like there's a chunk of that in the background of the art form that somehow mm-hmm. this was okay. And now we're kind of digging all that mm-hmm. stuff from underneath, or at least I hope we're continuing
yeah.
to dig.
Well, because I think that's part of what privilege is, right? Privilege is, oh, I didn't know that was an issue because I've never seen it or felt it. And so then leaving space when those voices do come up where it's like, oh, even though I may not have noticed this, that does not mean that it's not a thing. Because I feel like, too, right. like having been, you know, one or few women in a room, I know what it feels like to bring something up and to be the only perspective on that, and to, in some cases, feel heard, but in most cases, to feel like I was the uncool person or the jerk ruining everyone's fun. Even if I was heard, that tonally changes a room. And so I think it's my job to continue to try to educate myself so that I'm better at running those rooms and being aware of things that maybe have been overlooked.
But it's a tough position to be in, to have to, I mean, it just seems like with improv, if we are truly valuing our partner on stage and being open to what they have to offer and valuing it, it seems mm-hmm. like this art form should have less of those issues than mm-hmm. other places.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that and doesn't mean should. It's so, right?
No.
So.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. It should. And I don't. Yeah. And I do think, too, like getting to like meet people who do a better job of this, or like talk to other people who are also interested in that, I think that conversation is kind of new and really exciting. It's like, yeah, how do we do this thing in an imperfect world with a lot of different personalities and make sure that we're continuing to learn and grow and allow for growth and change in a way that is more positive than negative and more proactive than reactionary. I think I have lost a little bit of hope in the amount of change that is possible. quite yeah. honestly, because it's systemic, it's so many things. And I think that's part of it is, ideally we'd get to a place where everything was perfect, and that's not realistic. So I recognize yeah. that, like, I recognize that it's not realistic what I want, but I also think that the progress is so slow, if at all. I think theaters and companies are getting better at optic, but I don't know if we're doing the hard work of actually setting stuff up to change things. So I've like,
So what would be like, if there was one thing that you could make, wave a magic wand and say, this would make the biggest difference, that would be a a change to make?
I think better representation at higher levels of theaters and groups. So more
higher levels, meaning like the more veteran performers or what?
Or decision makers, like it depends on like what group you're talking about, but like the, you know, producers or the creative team or the hiring, the people who make the choices. So like if we're talking in theater, you know, the people who make the choices of what plays and how to cast and how we're working. So more representation and like, I guess like artistic directors and production teams and directors, there's a little bit more of that. But I feel like that if there was more representation higher up, I think that would make a huge difference. And so that people wouldn't have to be representative of their entire whatever. Because I think that's something too, like it's a very different conversation if I'll only speak for, I guess, as a woman, I guess like that's something that I can speak to, is like, it's a very different conversation if we're in a meeting and I'm one woman than if there's another woman there. Because then I'm not representing all women. I'm just voicing my opinion and I don't have to take on the burden of that.
Because otherwise, I mean, it's forcing you to carry weight that either you didn't ask to carry or shouldn't be expected to carry.
Yeah.
There was a interview on the David Letterman Netflix series with Tina Fey, where she talked about her experience as the first female writer on SNL, if I'm remembering that right. And she just talked about the impact of just having more women in that writing room and how that allowed, or at least had, was more fertile soil. But you've got to have more people in the room then.
If you look at like people like, do you know, have you heard of Amber Ruffin? She writes for Seth Meyers, and she is incredible in her own right, just as a human being and also as a writer and an artist. She was the first, I think the first female Black writer on a late night show. And she's used what she's gotten to make sure that she's opening doors for other POC and other women. And it's really beautiful to see.
This was on the Seth Meyers show that she got I mean, the show's been on for a little while, but it's not like it was on in
the 70s.
It's not that old.
No. And so like that too to me is like, holy moly, that's like, it's so late that that's true. Like, I remember when that article came out and I was like, the first? Yay. And also, crap, we're late.
Yeah. Well, as we're getting a little close to time, I guess I have two topics before I push things off to hopefully another conversation with you in another episode sometime. Well, let me ask this first, and then I want to chat with you about this week and some of your kind of notes to yourself. you have done a fair amount of teaching internationally, at least it seems to me, over the last few years at some of the festivals that seem to be getting bigger and more active in other parts of the world. What have you picked up about the art form of improv by going to these different places?
Ooh, that's a great question. That's so hard. It's nice to have a shared language, the language of improv, that can connect you to someone. Like anytime you find something that you share an interest with, it's amazing. So to have that shared interest with people all over the United States and in different countries is so cool to me, especially if you look like 10 years ago, this didn't exist in this way. And so that is just really exciting and amazing. And then just the generosity of the people that I've gotten to know at these festivals or that have brought me in, and generosity of in every way, has been very life-affirming or hopeful in a world or in a life that can occasionally feel hopeless or have those beautiful existential moments of like, well, what's the point? And I feel like sharing time, sharing workshop space and seeing like the generosity and the openness that people come to these workshops or these festivals with is so inspiring to me.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What's next for you internationally?
So I'm going on a huge trip, but the two main festivals are in Oslo and Barcelona.
Oh yeah. You've planned a midlife crisis. Is that what's going on?
Yeah. Well, I know.
It's like a Band-Aid. Just let her rip, right?
And exactly. It is.
And this is part of that. What else do you want to get through to feel like you've accomplished what you need to for a midlife crisis?
Oh gosh. You know, honestly, I did most of like the really like self-destructive stuff way earlier. So this is like a way more wholesome midlife crisis. Where it's like, I just want to eat good food and meet cool people.
Yeah, that doesn't sound all bad. So,
no.
All right, but you'll have to share what's going on there, and I know we can see some of that on social media. So, let's finish our time with what I don't know. Maybe this is the wrong way to finish it, but
no,
you had just moved back after spending some time in Chicago, a couple months in Chicago, mm-hmm. back to LA. Mm-hmm. And it sounded like you had a tough last week or two. You don't have to say why, but you had reminded yourself of something that you wrote back, and I think it was like 2013. So this is Andiel from 6 years ago speaking to Andiel in 2019.
Yes.
And this was kind of a download, wasn't it, about how you think you or others, at least in improv, should be working on things. Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about what led you to kind of go back to this?
Sure. So I spent 2 months in Chicago, mostly teaching children's summer camps at Second City. So teaching improvisation, sketch comedy, stand-up, and clowning in 2-week increments to students. And towards the end, I had a week that just felt hard. I taught an adult intensive that I felt like I was not my best self as a teacher. Like, I feel like in some ways I really failed. And then also had a group of kids that was so mean. And I was just like, what's happening? And it was burnt out because I'd been teaching a lot in the summer. So I think I was also like pretty tired. So I wasn't as elastic as I would have been earlier in the summer. So I got really down on myself just for that. Like, I'd not felt like that as a teacher in a long time. And so I kind of had a nice awakening that week that kind of like pulled me back into focus. And so I read this list of things and was just reminded that I was maybe taking myself a little bit too seriously again, which is something that I do relatively frequently.
Yeah. Well, there were a couple of notes that I thought were, it's a good article. It's on the Second City website, 15 reminders for every improviser if people want to look it up. But let me just kind of throw a couple out there and maybe you could just share a thought or two on it.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
The end does not justify the means.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean to you?
So initially, I wrote it about a process with a director that I did not get along with. And I felt like the process in improv is supposed to be the important part. We say it at Second City. And I think when we're our best, we also live by it, which means that failure has to be a part of it. And the process, we have to be in this process together. And so in this week of teaching, I feel like I was so focused on what I felt like I had to get to teaching them that I was not there with them in the process. And so in focusing on, this like curriculum that was maybe we weren't going to get there. Like, you can't get to the end without being on the ride. And I think for a second, I forgot to remember to be on the ride.
Hmm.
So like, I think if it's a good process, the product should reflect that. I believe that to be true in writing sketch comedy and also in classes is like, you'll get there. You'll get there better and you might get some extra things along the way. The end, even if it's a good product, if the process hurt in the wrong ways or was hard in the wrong ways, it does not justify being like, but we did a good show. Like, yeah, but we didn't do it the right way.
Yeah. I feel like this next one is one that you kind of talked a little bit about, but letting go of expectations.
Mm-hmm.
That's both expectations of yourself as well as maybe that others put on you. Is that?
Tell
me a little bit about that.
I feel like that's like in an improv scene, if you're expecting it to be one way, you won't play the scene that you're in. So you'll miss out like on the good scene because you're trying to get to whatever thing you think you're trying to do. And then similarly in life, it's like anytime I've had an expectation, there's like great quotes about it. It's like, you can't meet an expectation. You can only exceed it or not live up to it. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes I get so focused on like, but what's this supposed to be? Or what am I supposed to be? That I don't allow myself to just be what I am, where I am, and allow that to be enough.
Yeah, there's kind of a tension, I think, between having low expectations and just kind of being slothful about it.
Right.
As opposed to just kind of feeling like you shouldn't be so critical of yourself that you beat yourself up so that you don't move forward.
Right. And it's that like idea, too, of like, it's okay to have a goal or an intention, as long as you're willing to let it go, right? Like those things are not bad, but if you're so focused on those things that you're getting in your own way, then it's time to reassess if that is even the right goal.
How much of it do you think could be that you put your value in what the product is as opposed to yourself?
Oh, yes, 100%. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to point out one more and then we'll wrap up our interview here. Because I have a compliment to this last one. So I want to hear your angle on it. So I'm going to tell you my compliment to it. And then I'll read yours. So, sorry. So my statement that I use a lot is you always assume it's going to be better around the corner and it never is, which is a very negative kind of thing. But yours in this piece is the worst thing you can imagine will happen to you. I mean, it's kind of a little parallel. So how was this life affirming for you, Andiel?
Because it was true. Like, I think the other thing that I've been guilty of is like, you can't reframe something before you live it. And so like, I feel like being able to say this thing was bad, there's something about being able to say that out loud that for me at least can take the power out. Because when people are like, everything is an opportunity, like it's the same thing. But if you say that to me, I'm going to be like, no, something bad happened. Don't try to make this good. Yeah. Let it be bad. Because I have to feel it before I can figure it out or not figure it out. You know, like sometimes things are bad. So why are we pretending that's not okay? I think that gets in our way or gets in my way. I don't want to speak for everyone.
Yeah. Well, I think you can speak for a lot of us. And thank you for making that actually a positive thing. So, Andiel, I'm going to put in the show notes ways that people can connect with you and all that kind of stuff. But I've really enjoyed having you on the Improv Comedy Connection. And hopefully we get to talk again real soon.
Yes. Thank you for having me. This was fun.
That's episode one. We discussed how good improv might feature presence and connection. And after the interview, it kind of struck me that another way to describe that could be authentic vulnerability and openness. Anyway, I appreciate that we got to talk a bit, not only about the good stuff and the high points, but also the struggles and the importance about acknowledging them for what they are. Being real with the good and the bad in life is something that I think audiences want to see from performers and communicators, and it made for an interesting, insightful conversation. I hope you thought so too. As I said earlier, Andiel teaches with Second City and also is definitely on the improv festival circuit, both in the States and in Europe. You can find her at yesandiel.com. And I'll link to her social media accounts and pages on the episode page at improvcomedyconnection.com. If there's an improv festival within reach, there's a pretty good chance you might be able to catch Andiel teaching a workshop. And if she's there, find a way to get that experience with her. If this episode has been useful to you, please spread the word, rate, and subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you think this could be more useful, or you have a great idea for a topic or a guest for a future episode, let me know. I'm doing this to help you as we work together to connect more deeply with each other and our audiences through comedy. It's been my pleasure to be your host on this first episode of the Improv Comedy Connection. My name again is Whit Schiller, and I'm an improviser out of Milwaukee with Fish Sticks Comedy. We also have local troops in Atlanta and Dallas, and we'll soon be adding a troupe in Denver. You can check out the work we do at fishstickscomedy.com, and you can connect with me on social media at Whit Schiller on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and heck, I just discovered my MySpace page is still up from a million years ago. Thanks again for tuning into the Improv Comedy Connection.